You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archived materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. This month, we are celebrating Evidence Locker's third birthday, as well as our 150th episode. We decided to do a blockbuster theme for the month of July. This week, we revisit Steven Spielberg's powerful film Munich and take a look at the 1972 Munich Olympics massacre and the retaliation that followed. Warning, this episode contains details of terrorist attacks and may not be suitable for all listeners. The Summer Olympics of 1972 took place in the Bavarian city of Munich, West Germany. The city opened its arms to welcome international athletes, officials, and spectators. Events kicked off on the 26th of August, and they were off to a great start. The opening ceremony alone made broadcasting history, raking in record viewer numbers around the world. Millions of people were watching events, cheering on their nation's best athletes. American swimmer Mark Spitz became swimming royalty, winning 7 gold medals. The USSR's basketball team caused an upset by beating the USA in the last second with a long shot. Munich 1972 was the 20th Olympic Games, and West Germany was keen to prove that they had evolved and rebuilt their country in the decades following World War II. It was hard to forget the Nazi-flavored 1936 Berlin Olympics, and it was an opportunity to wipe the slate clean. The West German Olympic Organizing Committee was adamant to host a flawless, welcoming, and inclusive tournament. In the end, the Games of that year would be memorable for all the wrong reasons. A hostage drama and a botched rescue attempt left 17 people dead. The events that transpired in the wake of the tragedy inspired the book Vengeance by George Jonas, which eventuated in an epic film directed by Steven Spielberg, simply called Munich. In a world where eye for an eye justice reigned, there was no podium, no world records, only those who lost everything. The 1936 Berlin Olympics was a grotesque affair with cannon fire, swastika flags waving all over the stadium, and thousands raising their arms in the Nazi salute of Heil Hitler. Instead of celebrating the best of the best in sport, Hitler used the event as a vehicle for Nazi propaganda. It was an ominous prelude to the war that was brewing, and Hitler lapped up every minute. What followed, one of the most destructive wars the world has ever experienced, was still fresh in everyone's memory 27 years after it ended. Hosting the Olympic Games in Germany was a delicate matter, and organizers' biggest challenge was to place Germany in a good light. They didn't want any reminders of the Second World War. No violence and no fear. Preparing security for the Games was of the utmost importance. 2,000 security guards were appointed and could be spotted everywhere at events, wearing baby blue sports jackets and white caps. There was to be no military presence, and for the most part, Munich police could only have a discreet presence, carrying no weapons, only smiles. It was essential to let the world know that Germany was no longer Nazi territory. Organizers wanted to be prepared for anything and asked forensic psychologist and terrorism expert George Sieber to prepare 26 possible scenarios that could play out. Out of his scenarios, Situation 21 warned of a Palestinian attack on Israeli athletes, including a hostage situation. Sieber theorized that the terrorist would likely demand the release of Palestinian prisoners in exchange for the Israeli athletes. In such situations, it would be typical for the attackers to kill one hostage, so as to serve as a warning to others to comply. However, preparing for this situation would have required heavier security, which could have caused panic and ruined the carefree spirit of the event. That is when Dr. Sieber was reportedly asked to come up with a different scenario that was more aligned with the event the organizers had in mind. Perhaps the Olympic Committee did not want to consider the possibility of a terrorist attack because the implication was too ghastly to contemplate. Once the games were underway, things were running smoothly. There was a festive atmosphere as athletes from all over the world competed for gold on the field and socialized as friends when it was all done. They encouraged each other and shared tips and techniques. Journalists who covered the Olympics that year recalled that security seemed non-existent, especially in the athlete's village where as long as you wore a tracksuit, you'd be waved through. Having the Israeli team at the Games was historically significant. Witnessing them marching in the opening ceremony in Germany was a poignant moment for international relations. In an effort to address the unspeakable horrors that occurred in that very country only a few decades before, a memorial was held at Dachau concentration camp, 6 miles from the Olympic Village. The Israeli team paid their respects in an emotional ceremony, and the world watched the broadcast. Israeli team manager Shmuel Lalkin raised his concerns about the lack of security provided for his team. Their presence stirred up a lot of emotion, and he would have preferred armed protection. Lalkin was promised increased security, but no additional measures were taken. The location of their appointed housing left them vulnerable. The Israeli team's apartments were in a somewhat isolated part of the Olympic Village, on the ground floor of a building, with the security gate being their only protection. The two female Israeli teammates had their own apartment, in a different housing section to their male counterparts. The sailing team was in Kiel, in the north of West Germany. The remaining 13 team members shared 3 townhouse-style apartments at 31 Kanalistrasse. The first apartment was where the coaches and referees stayed. Apartment 2 housed track athletes and support staff. Weightlifters and wrestlers shared the third apartment. Monday, the 4th of September, was a beautifully mild evening in Munich. It was the second week of the games, and most of the athletes had completed the competition. The Israeli team and their families went out for a night at the theater to watch their fellow countryman, Shmuel Rodensky, starring in Fiddler on the Roof. After the show, the actor joined the team for dinner. They took a bus back to the athletes' village where they arrived around midnight. It had been a long day and night out, and they all went straight to bed. Outside their building, at 4:30 a.m., 8 men in tracksuits scaled a 6.5-foot chain-link fence, along with some unsuspecting drunken Canadian athletes who had missed their curfew. They hoisted each other up and patted each other on the backs before going their separate ways. The group of 8 carried duffel bags containing AK-47 assault rifles, Tokari pistols, hand grenades, ski masks, amphetamines, and a first aid kit. They made their way to the Israeli quarters and, using stolen keys, quietly entered apartment 1. The first to notice them was wrestling coach Josef Gutfreund, who woke up because he heard a scratching noise at the door. When he went closer to investigate, he saw the front end of a rifle as they opened the door. Gutfreund jumped on the door, barricading it with his 300-pound body, and shouted so his roommates could wake up. He yelled, "Havatistalku," which translates to "take cover, boys." When weightlifting coach Tuvia Sokolovsky saw the intruders coming in, he broke a window with his fist and escaped. The intruders forced another wrestling coach, 33-year-old Moshe Weinberg, to take them to the athletes. The leader of the terrorist group remained in apartment 1, keeping an eye on his colleagues. Weinberg, who by this time had suffered a gunshot wound to the face, lied about the athletes in apartment 2 and said they were not part of the Israeli team. With his back against the wall, as a matter of speaking, he made a decision that he thought would give them the best chance to retaliate. Apartment 2 did house Israelis, but they were track and field athletes. Weinberg opted to lead the attackers to the strongest men in the team, the wrestlers and weightlifters. But the sleeping athletes, no matter how strong they were, had no chance against the arsenal of firearms their masked attackers had brought with them. David Berger, an American from Ohio with dual citizenship, shouted to his teammates to attack, seeing as they had nothing to lose. Before they could attack the intruders, the athletes were all overpowered and made to march back to apartment 1. Weinberg realized that this would be a fight to the death and attacked one of the gunmen, allowing Gad Sabari, one of his wrestlers, to escape via an underground garage. The terrorist fired at Sabari, but he just kept on running and managed to escape. Meanwhile, Weinberg had rendered one of the assailants unconscious and stabbed another one with a fruit knife before he was shot and killed. His bullet-riddled body was thrown out of the building onto the pavement outside of 31 Kanalistrasse. The 8 attackers were left with 10 hostages: wrestling coach Josef Gutfreund, sharpshooting coach Kehat Shor, track and field coach Amitzur Shapira, fencing master Andre Spitzer, weightlifting judge Yakov Springer, wrestlers Eliezer Halfin, 18-year-old Soviet resident Mark Slavin, and weightlifters Zaev Friedman and David Berger. Yosef Romano, a weightlifter, followed Weinberger's lead and also attacked one of the gunmen, only to be shot dead with an AK-47. Then, there were nine. The others were tied up, four in a row on two beds facing each other in Springer and Shapira's room. Gutfreund was the largest of the hostages, and he was tied to his own chair with a rope. Yosef Romano's body was left at their feet to serve as a warning. During this time, waiting for the world to catch on to what was happening, the hostages suffered several beatings to keep them in check. The residents of Apartment 2 awoke hearing shouting and gunshots. Team manager Shmuel Lalkin, four track athletes and two team doctors realized the situation was bad. Racewalker Shaw Ladney escaped through a window and made it to the American section of the Olympic Village. He woke track coach Bill Bowerman and told him about the ambush. Bowerman raised the alarm with the U.S. Embassy in Berlin. By this time, escapee Gad Sobari had made it to the press hub and asked the early-hour journalist to contact police. Weightlifting coach Tuvia Sokolovsky, bloodied and injured after jumping from the window, ran until he found a police officer before he collapsed in tears and shock. The team members in Apartment 2 remained hidden and eventually managed to escape unharmed. As soon as he reached a telephone, Shmuel Lalkin called the Sheraton in Munich where the Israeli journalists resided for the duration of the games. He informed them about the situation, urgently shouted to call Israel. Police became involved at 5:30 a.m., They found Moshe Weinberg's body on the pavement and arranged for an ambulance to take him away. At 6 a.m., the contact between the terrorists and German authorities commenced. A typed list of demands was thrown out of a window and floated to the sidewalk below. It was noted that a group called the Black September Organization, or BSO, a militant Palestinian organization, was behind the ambush. The BSO were known for their ruthless acts, like assassinating the Prime Minister of Jordan, Wasfi Tal. The BSO demanded the release of 234 Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. He also wanted the release of the founders of the Red Army faction, Andrea Bader and Ulrike Meinhof, who was being held in West Germany. If they did not receive confirmation of the releases, they were going to shoot the hostages. The German-speaking negotiator identified himself as Issa. In an effort to disguise himself, he had smeared his face with black shoe polish and wore a white hat and sunglasses. The world's media was already in Munich, and instead of covering track, pool, and gymnastics events, they gathered at Connollystrasse and broadcasted events, live for the whole world to see. It was an explosive and extremely sensitive issue. Jewish athletes were being held captive in Germany. The world was not ready for it. The whole event unfolded in uncanny similarity to Dr. Sieber's prediction, Situation 21. The one that did not fit into the baby blue suit and dimpled smile vibe organizers wanted to create. Israel's Prime Minister, Golda Meir, responded to Black September's demands before the deadline and said that Israel would not release the prisoners and made it clear that Israel would not negotiate with terrorists. She said, "If Israel should give in, then no Israeli anywhere in the world shall feel that his life is safe. It's blackmail of the worst kind." Olympic Village security and Munich police were caught completely off guard and neglected to evacuate the immediate area. Journalists and curious spectators gathered at the scene. If the terrorists opened fire into the crowd, it could have had catastrophic results. Fortunately, they did not. It was a strange situation as the news spread through Munich that morning. For the most part, scheduled Olympic events carried on. While West German and Bavarian police joined forces to deal with the hostage crisis, the men's heavyweight boxing quarterfinals took place. Germany played Australia in a basketball qualifier, and Poland beat the Soviet Union 2-1 in the men's football semifinals. Later in the afternoon, organizers realized the magnitude of the hostage situation, and events were finally suspended until further notice. Meanwhile, the families, friends, and loved ones of all the hostages back home in Israel held their breaths as they watched how negotiations dragged on for hours. German authorities were desperate to resolve the situation and made an open offer of an unlimited amount of cash to be paid in exchange for the hostages. The captors insisted that it was not about money, only about freeing the prisoners. Police bluffed and told the BSO negotiator that Israel was willing to trade. but they needed to know if the athletes were still alive and well. ISSA agreed to grant access to two members of the Olympic Committee. The men cautiously made their way to Apartment 1, where they were appalled to see the blood from the shootings and feel the palpable fear of athletes being held hostage. After the quick recce, they reported back to police that there were 5 gunmen inside. Actually, there was 8. This miscalculation would be detrimental to the rescue operation in the hours that followed. Negotiators said they were waiting for instruction from Jerusalem and begged ISSA to extend the deadline. He agreed to 5 p.m., but threatened that he would kill one hostage publicly every hour they had to extend the deadline. Plainclothes police officers accessed the roof of the apartment block, hoping to gain entry from the top. But captors saw what was going on by watching TV coverage inside the apartment. The command came to stand down. At 5 p.m., ISSA changed his demands and requested an airplane to transport his group as well as their hostages to Cairo, Egypt. Police saw an opportunity to intercept and save the hostages somewhere en route. At 10 p.m., the gunmen and their captives all entered a bus in the underground parking lot of 31 Connolly Strasse. It transported them to a helipad only 200 meters away, where 2 helicopters were standing by to airlift them to Fürstenfeldbruck, a NATO airbase nearby. Ordinary police officers were pulled in to act as snipers and were placed all along the way. A decree was issued in Germany after the war, prohibiting the German army to get involved in domestic affairs. All specialist snipers were in the army, and police did not train their officers in sharpshooting. In this scenario, police shooters were placed at strategic spots, but they were hesitant to shoot. They did not want to risk harming the hostages. West German police never had the intention of allowing the group to leave and planted undercover officers inside the aircraft to pose as aircrew. ISSA and his deputy, a cowboy hat-wearing man he referred to as Tony, were supposed to board the plane to inspect. The officers were ordered to shoot them as soon as they boarded. Sharpshooters would then shoot the other 3 terrorists in the helicopters. However, officers on the plane decided it was a suicide mission, as they feared the terrorists would activate a hand grenade and they would all die. So the officers got off the plane and disappeared into the crowd. Soon, everything came undone. Firstly, the helicopters landed in the wrong position, so the police shooters were not able to see the passengers. They were also only looking for 5 targets, when in fact there were 8. Quiet tension rose as police officers and journalists standing outside the fence watched ISSA and Tony board the airplane. They saw no one on board and realized it was a trap. They ran back to the helicopter and police fired at them, missing ISSA and injuring Tony. A grueling 30-minute shootout ensued between the terrorists and West German police. All the hostages were tied up in the helicopters and could only hope that it would end in their favor. But it didn't. For a brief moment, the gunfire stopped, and news leaked to the media that everyone was safe and that it was over. However, this was premature. Police had ceased fire, only to request urgent backup. When armored vehicles arrived at the airport, one of the Black Septemberists panicked and threw a live grenade into one of the helicopters, killing some of the Israeli athletes instantly. Another terrorist fired his AK-47 into the second helicopter, killing all of the others. Just after 3 a.m., almost 24 hours since the attack began, the news of the true disaster that took place was revealed. ABC Sports correspondent Jim McKay's word became the backtrack to the event that shook the world.
2 were killed in their rooms yesterday morning. 9 were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone.
All of the Israeli athletes had been killed. 5 of the 8 members of Black September were dead, and a West German police officer was struck down in the crossfire. It was unbelievable. The entire world bore witness to an unspeakable tragedy in real time. Much like the September 11th attacks, everyone stood by, helpless, unsure what to do next. A memorial service was held the next day, paying respect to the Israeli victims, as well as the fallen German police officer. After a day of no events, the Olympic Games resumed, with the scheduled events going ahead 24 hours after the initial program. The day after the attacks, the remainder of the Israeli team flew back to Israel with the bodies of their teammates. David Bergman's body was repatriated to his family in Ohio. Jewish athletes representing other countries, like America's gold medalist Mark Spitz, also left Munich as soon as they could, while the siege was still underway, fearing they could be targeted too. However, BSO made it clear that their issue was not religious. It was not an anti-Semitic attack, but rather a stand against the State of Israel for occupying Arab Palestine and forcing their people into refugee camps. The bodies of the five attackers were flown to Libya, where they were buried as heroes. A spokesperson for the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, declared, "Operation Ikrit and Birim had 100% publicity success." But violence was not the way to gain the rest of the world's sympathy, and Israeli authorities were not going to take the massacre sitting down. No less than 2 days after the event, Israeli forces retaliated by bombing PLO bases in Syria and Lebanon, in turn causing the deaths of many innocent people. The main role players were identified by Israel's National Intelligence Agency, Mossad. Abu Iyad, Yasser Arafat's co-founder of the Fatah, Abu Daoud, Arafat's right-hand man, and Ali Hassan Salameh, known by his nickname the Red Prince, who was in charge of working out the details of the Munich attack. These three men did not take part in the events, but put together the cell of eight terrorists. They recruited the men, all members of Fatah, living in refugee camps in Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. They were young, all of them in their late teens or early 20s, and had spent most of their lives growing up in the harsh conditions of refugee camps. A hatred towards Israel came with the territory. The eight were handpicked from a short list of 50, after completing intensive guerrilla training. They accepted the job with honor and believed that they were doing it for the greater good. The thinking was to create a shocking international event to shine a light on the Palestinian cause. In the book, The Mossad, Six Landmark Missions on the Israeli Intelligence Agency, author Mark E. Vargo quotes Iranian-born British-educated psychologist Fatali Mogadam, explaining the notion. From the terrorist's point of view, terrorism is a rational problem-solving strategy. With logistical assistance from German neo-Nazis, Commander Lutif Aviv led the operation and also served as a negotiator using the code name Issa. He had a Jewish mother and a Christian father, and three of his brothers were all members of Black September, two of them in Israeli jails. Aviv was an experienced soldier who gained experience in the Jordan War. He had studied engineering in Berlin and was fluent in German, so was a natural choice as the leader. He'd be able to negotiate with German authorities and avoid miscommunication. His deputy was 25-year-old Yusuf Nazal, or Tony. He had similar experience to Aviv and could also speak German. Aviv and Nazal were thoroughly briefed about the ambush and knew exactly how it was supposed to play out. The junior members of the cell were kept in the dark, ensuring no information would be leaked. The operation, as they would learn only hours before the attack, was named Ikrit and Birim, after two Palestinian Christian villages. In 1948, during the Arab-Israeli War, Israel Defense Forces, IDF, forced all inhabitants out. The name insinuated that the siege at the Munich Olympics was an act of revenge. The trained men arrived, along with spectators from all over the world, via train and airplane in the days before. They were still not sure what the mission was and killed time doing sightseeing in Munich and familiarizing themselves with the Olympic Village. Lutif Aviv worked with the construction team in the Olympic Village as a qualified civil engineer. Nazal secured a job as a cook in one of the canteens. This gave them time and opportunity to scout their victims and finalize their plans to attack. A Uruguayan athlete told police that he saw one of the terrorists inside 31 Connolly Strasse the day before the ambush, but did not find it suspicious, as he had seen him around the village before. He was referring to Nazal. Operation Ikrit and Birim were supposed to unfold as follows. The group of eight BSO militants would take the Israeli Olympic team hostage inside their living quarters. Because of the high profile of the Olympic Games, they counted on the possibility that Israel would make an exception and negotiate to ensure their release. If their demands were not met within 24 hours, they would arrange an airplane that would take all the hostages to an Arab nation, from where negotiations would continue. the only surviving member of Black September, told his version of events in the Academy Award-winning documentary, One Day in September. He said they were excited to confront Israel on behalf of all Palestinians. The group of eight were told not to kill, only in self-defense, which in his opinion is why Weinberg and Romano were killed. In 2012, German news magazine Der Spiegel published an article claiming that an informer in Beirut provided information about the attack 2 weeks before it happened, and West German authorities failed to act. But the issue wasn't between Germany and Israel, or Germany and the Palestinians. It was the Arab-Israeli conflict, a turnstile of attack and retaliation. Police managed to arrest the three surviving terrorists on the runway at Fürstenfeldbruck: Adnan Al-Gashay, Jamal Al-Gashay, and Mohammed Safadi. A month later, Lufthansa Flight 615 from Beirut to Frankfurt was hijacked, and the hijackers demanded their release. West German authorities were desperate to put the Munich massacre behind them, so they complied, washing their hands of the terrorists. In a massive act of counterterrorism, the Israeli government gave the green light to their national intelligence agency, Mossad, to direct a retaliation effort called Operation Wrath of God. And this is where Steven Spielberg's blockbuster film Munich begins. The film is based on a book, Vengeance, by Canadian journalist and author George Jonas. The main source of information was Juval Aviv, a Mossad agent in the thick of things. Although the validity of his account had been brought into question over the years, Operation Wrath of God was everything but fiction. Jonas and his publisher concluded that Aviv's story was discredited by the Israeli government, who did not want to make it known that this string of assassinations was ordered by the prime minister. Before Spielberg made the film, he personally vetted and interviewed Aviv and was satisfied that his account was legit. Spielberg's researchers uncovered FBI files that supported most of Aviv's claims. In the end, it is so that there are certain things one simply cannot make up. Mossad chief Zvi Zamir convinced Golda Meir that the most powerful form of retaliation would be a personal, targeted attack on every single individual involved in the planning, bankrolling, and execution of the Munich massacre. Although this breached international law, Meir agreed. A series of targeted assassinations followed, spanning over many years and continents. When Aviv agreed to lead a group of secret operatives in the mission, he was sent to Geneva, where he was given access to a Swiss bank account with $250,000 to fund operational expenses. A Mossad agent, who did not know anything about the operation, was tasked with topping up the account, so it would always contain $250,000. Aviv's handler, simply known as Ephraim, handed him a list of 12 names, all Black Septemberists or PLO members, prominent figures that, if taken out, would cause the Palestinian terrorist network to implode. At the same time, Mossad targeted Palestinian youths using psychological tactics, like placing their obituaries in local newspapers as a grim warning. The idea was to topple all anti-Israeli efforts by calling it from the top and the bottom. But who decided those names made it onto the hit list? Mossad agents compiled an extensive list of players, which was sent to Committee X. Aviv and his team were under strict orders to take out the target only, and that no innocent bystanders should be harmed during an execution. They should also not have any doubt as to the target's identity. How they killed them was up to Aviv and the members of his team. And so, the string of assassinations begun. The first person on the list was a Palestinian poet called Wael Zweiter, who was based in Rome. He was Yasser Arafat's cousin, and use words instead of weapons to incite violence, openly criticizing the state of Israel's treatment of Palestinians. Mossad was convinced that Zweiter had deeper roots in terrorist organizations than he let on, which is why he had made the list. Specifically, that he played a role in the bombing of an El Al flight in August 1972, only weeks before the Munich massacre. Aviv and one of his team members watched as Zweiter arrived home after an early dinner. A young couple, well, Mossad agents posing as a couple, walked just ahead of him as he made his way home. Another female agent spotted them from across the road and ran over to them to happily greet them. All of these agents were on a need-to-know basis and did not know they were giving a signal to two assassins. As Whiter waited for the elevator in the lobby of his apartment building, two gunmen stepped out of the shadows, asked him if he was Wael Zwider. Zwider was confused when he saw the pistols pointed at him, and before he could answer, he was brought down in a hail of gunfire. Aviv and his group evacuated Rome immediately, and Zwider's killing remained unsolved. This became their typical MO. Teams were tasked with surveillance, usually involving female agents, as they attracted less attention. Then, there was the logistical aspect, sourcing whatever was needed to carry out an attack and setting up the moment of the assassination. Lastly, agents with military experience would execute their target. After Zwitter's death, his friends and colleagues came forward in his defense, claiming he was a pacifist who had nothing to do with terrorist attacks. Their next target took them to France, where 38-year-old Dr. Mahmoud Hamshari unwittingly awaited his fate. A Palestinian historian and PLO envoy in Paris, Dr. Hamshari appeared to be nothing but a wealthy, well-educated gentleman. However, Mossad had evidence linking him to Black September in France. In fact, they believed that he was second in command. He was also linked to a failed assassination attempt on former Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion during a state visit to Denmark, as well as the bombing of a Swiss air flight from Zurich to Tel Aviv that killed 47 passengers. Aviv's team were aware of the fact that Hamshari conducted his business from home and had to be careful not to harm his wife and young daughter in the course of his assassination. They planted a bomb in the telephone at his luxurious Rue Delicia apartment. With the help of Mossad agent Zvi Malkin, who was part of the team who retrieved Nazi high official Adolf Eichmann from Argentina, Aviv's team, posing as phone repairmen, entered their target's apartment to plant the bomb. Because Hamshari's wife and daughter lived with him, they could not simply have a mechanical trigger on the bomb. They had to make sure the person holding the receiver was Mahmoud Hamshari and no one else. Keeping surveillance on the apartment, they familiarized themselves with the family's routine. When Marie-Claude Hamshari and their daughter Amina had left and were out of sight, they called Mahmoud Hamshari. The phone exploded and rendered him severely injured, but not dead. But after 3 weeks in hospital, Dr. Mahmoud Hamshari succumbed to his injuries. If the message wasn't clear after Wael Zwitter's assassination, Palestinian leaders in Europe heard it loud and clear after Hamshari's death. Many Black Septemberists and PLO leaders went underground, which made them harder to find, but Mossad were up to the task. More than 30 agents were involved, working independently with limited contact. For the most part, they did not form part of regular Mossad operations, and even long-serving agents in Tel Aviv did not know the identity of agents working on Wrath of God. Abad al-Shir was an extremist and PLO's envoy to Cyprus. He was also in frequent contact with KGB operatives, trading weapons to ensure the Soviets would train PLO soldiers. Aviv's team plotted his assassination and vowed that they would ensure he does not survive his attack, like Hamshari did in Paris. They followed him to the ironically named Olympic Hotel in Nicosia, where they hit a bomb in his mattress. The blast was unexpectedly powerful and nearly caused a catastrophe with a newlywed Jewish couple in the room next to al-Shir's. Fortunately, they only suffered minor injuries, but it was a close call. Black September, realizing that Mossad was attacking on their most prominent members, arranged the assassination of Barak Cohen, a Mossad agent in Madrid. Cohen was shot in the chest in a cafe in broad daylight, and as soon as he was pronounced dead, Black September claimed responsibility. More attacks followed throughout 1973, causing a silent war of assassinations between Black September and autonomous teams of off-the-record Mossad agents. But three big fishes were still out there. The main engineers of the Munich massacre, Abu Iyad, Abu Dawood, and Red Prince Ali Hassan Salameh. Agents followed Salameh to Scandinavia, where they believed he was plotting an attack on the Israeli consulate in Stockholm. However, Salameh made his way to Lillehammer, Norway. In a botched surveillance operation, they shot and killed an olive-skinned man, mistaking him for Salameh. The victim was 30-year-old Moroccan-born waiter Ahmed Bouchiki. Norwegian authorities were furious and refused to cover up the blunder. They publicly pointed the finger at the State of Israel, and all Israeli covert operations in the area had to be pulled. Mossad had no more support from Norway, and all logistical assistance in safe houses were closed to them. Operation Wrath of God was not complete until they had taken out Salome, the mastermind of the Munich massacre. Thanks to undercover agent Erica Chambers, Mossad were able to catch up with him. Posing as an English expat who loved cats and painting, she spent hours on her balcony in central Beirut, observing Salome's movements in the streets below. He usually drove in a convoy, surrounded with bodyguards. Beka Street was the way to his mother's house, so it was a route he took frequently. On Monday, the 22nd of January, 1979, Mossad agents laid in wait, knowing that Salome was attending his niece's birthday party at his mother's house in the afternoon. They had planted a bomb in a Volkswagen, parked next to the road, and as soon as his convoy passed it, they flipped the switch. A massive blast shook the entire neighborhood. An eyewitness recalled, "It was like hell. There was a flash, then a big bang. It was incredible. I'd never seen anything like it before, not even in Beirut. It was as if the whole city was on fire. So many dead people, burnt cars, and young bodies littering the street." Salome survived the blast and stumbled out of his vehicle, but metal shards had lodged in his head, causing him to die in hospital some hours later. Besides Salome, 9 other people died in the blast. Although Mossad did not get to Abu Iyad directly, one of his bodyguards turned on him, shooting him with an AK-47 in 1991. It is believed Mossad backed the bodyguard who was acting on behalf of another faction in the PLO. The last of the 3 men behind the Munich massacre to die was Abu Daoud, who succumbed to kidney failure in Syria in 2010. He never regretted his actions and maintained that it was necessary to make the world aware of the Palestinian cause. As for the 3 surviving terrorists who held the athletes hostage, one was assassinated by Mossad. Another one died due to heart failure, though many believe it was staged by Mossad. The 3rd one is still alive and spoke for the first time, without showing his face, on the documentary One Day in September. So much blood has been shed before, during, and after the Munich massacre. Acts of terror caused acts of retaliation. But where would it all end? Leviticus 24, verses 19 through 20 says, "If someone injures his neighbor, just as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Just as he has injured a person, so shall it be inflicted on him." Steven Spielberg's film humanizes the people behind the events that took place in the aftermath of the 1972 Summer Olympics. In the end, so many lives were lost. Even those who were still breathing were shells of their former selves, broken by blood-stained memories. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe on Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.